This is Audible.
Random House Audiobooks presents The Greatest Generation by Tom Brokaw. Read for you by the author.
The Greatest Generation. In the spring of 1984, I went to the northwest of France, to Normandy, to prepare an NBC documentary on the 40th anniversary of D-Day, the massive and daring Allied invasion of Europe that marked the beginning of the end of Adolf Hitler's Third Reich. I was well prepared with research on the planning for the invasion, the numbers of men, ships, airplanes, and weapons involved, the tactical and strategic errors of the Germans, and the names of the Normandy villages that in the midst of battle provided critical support to the invaders. What I was not prepared for was the emotional impact this experience would have on me. When I began working on the 40th anniversary, I was excited by the history. My earliest memories were of that war. Between the ages of 3 and 5, I lived on an army base in western South Dakota, and I spent a good deal of my time outdoors in a tiny helmet shooting stick guns at imaginary German and Japanese soldiers. The first time I ever saw my mother cry was when the army base commander decided my father, Red Brokaw, a Mr. Fix-It and an all-purpose operator of snowplows and construction machinery, was too valuable to the base operations and had him brought back home when he was drafted. These were powerful images for an impressionable boy. The war effort was all around us. Ammunition was tested on the South Dakota sagebrush prairie before being shipped out to the battlefront positions. Neighbors always seemed to be going off to or coming home from the war. There was even a stockade of Italian prisoners of war living on the edge of the base. My grandfather followed the war's progress on his maps. My wife Meredith, raised in Yankton, South Dakota, to which the Brokaws moved later, was born shortly before her father, a doctor, was shipped out to Europe. She saw him only once when he returned from the war when she was 3, and then not again until she was 5. And so, as it turned out, I had stored up a reservoir of memories of that dramatic time in America. Yet, when I arrived in Normandy 40 years later, those memories had receded, replaced by days of innocence in the 50s, by my covering the turmoil of Vietnam and the social upheavals of the 60s, Watergate in the 70s, and by my traveling the world for NBC News. I was thinking much more about the prospects of the Cold War than the lessons of the war of my early years, and I was simply looking forward to what I thought would be an interesting assignment in a part of France celebrated for its hospitality, seafood, and Calvados, the local brandy made of apples. Instead, I underwent a life-changing experience. As I walked the Normandy beaches with the American veterans who had landed there and returned for the 40th anniversary, men at the time in their 60s and 70s, and listened to their stories of the war and the lessons they took from it into the useful lives they built afterward, I was deeply moved and profoundly grateful that I was witness to their acts of heroism and bravery in time of war and to what they gave to America and the world in the years after it. These men and women, born between 1910 and on into the 1920s, came of age in the Great Depression, when economic despair was on the land like a plague. They had watched their parents lose their businesses, their farms, their jobs, their hope. They had learned to accept a future that played out one day at a time. Then, just as there was a glimmer of economic recovery, war exploded across Europe and Asia. When Pearl Harbor made it irrefutably clear that America was not a fortress, this generation was summoned to the parade ground and told to train for war. They left their ranches in Sully County, South Dakota, their jobs on the main street of Americus, Georgia. They gave up their places on the assembly lines in Detroit and the ranks of Wall Street. They quit school or went from cap and gown directly into uniform. They answered the call to help save the world from the two most powerful and ruthless military machines ever assembled, instruments of conquest in the hands of fascist maniacs. They faced great odds and a late start, but they did not protest. At a time in their lives when their days and nights should have been filled with innocent adventure, love, and the lessons of the workaday world, they were fighting, often hand-to-hand in the most primitive possible conditions, across the bloody landscape of France, Belgium, Italy, Austria. They fought their way up a necklace of South Pacific islands few had ever heard of before, and made those islands a fixed part of American history. The islands had names such as Iwo Jima, Guadalcanal, Okinawa. They were in the air every day, in skies filled with terror, and they went to sea on hostile waters far removed from the shores of their homeland. New branches of the service were formed to get women into uniform, working a task that would free more men for combat. Other women served out of uniform, going to work in the laboratories and in the factories, developing new machines, building ships, planes, and tanks, raising their families all alone. America's preeminent physicists were engaged in a secret race to build a new bomb before Germany figured out how to harness the atom as a weapon. Without their efforts and sacrifices, our world would be a far different place today. These veterans came home to joyous and short-lived celebrations and immediately began their task of rebuilding their lives and the world they wanted. They were mature beyond their years, tempered by what they had been through, disciplined by their military training and sacrifices, and knowledgeable, too. They had gotten to know and respect people they never would have met before. They had been places they never would have been otherwise. And they had learned the true value of a life. They married in record numbers and gave birth to another distinctive generation, the baby boomers. They stayed true to old American values of duty and honor and service, faith, taking personal responsibility for one's actions. A grateful nation made it possible for more of them to attend college than in any society ever before, anywhere. The GI Bill for that education was the gift of a grateful nation for service and sacrifice, and it filled to capacity the colleges and universities across the country. Campus classrooms and housing were overflowing with young men, many of whom had never expected to get a college education. They left those campuses with degrees and a determination to make up for lost time. They were a new kind of Army now, moving onto the landscape of industry, science, art, public policy, all fields of American life, bringing to every endeavor the same passion and discipline that had served them so well during the war. They helped convert wartime industry facilities into what became the most powerful economy in history. They made breakthroughs in science and gave the world new art. They came to understand the need for federal civil rights legislation. They helped give America Medicare. They rebuilt the infrastructure of their former enemies, and they stood fast against totalitarianism in a new form, communism. They were rocked by the social and political upheavals of the 60s. Many of them hated the long hair, the free love, and especially what they saw as desecration of the flag. But in the end, they didn't give up on this new generation. They weren't perfect. They made mistakes. They allowed McCarthyism and racism to go unchallenged for too long. Women of the World War II generation, who had demonstrated convincingly that they had so much more to offer than what could be seen only in the milieu of their households, became the underpinning for the liberation of their gender, even as many of their husbands resisted that idea. When a new war broke out, many of the veterans initially failed to recognize the many differences between their war and the one being waged in Vietnam. Yet, as I began to listen to their stories, the themes of greatness and the living of ordinary lives began to appear. Their stories did not come forth easily. They didn't volunteer them. I learned to stay back a step or two, listening as they walked the beaches themselves, quietly exchanging memories. When I returned to Normandy again for the 50th anniversary of D-Day, my wife Meredith joined me. By 1994, I felt a kind of missionary zeal for the men and women of the World War II generation, and I'd begun spreading the word of their remarkable lives. I was inspired by them, by their example, and by their values. The work of my friend Stephen Ambrose also inspired me, the energetic, plain-talking historian who had written the account of the invasion called simply D-Day, June 6, 1944. From him, I had learned that the men and women told the stories best themselves. So I said to Meredith, "Whenever one of these guys comes over to say hello, just ask, where were you that day?" And so we did, wherever we went. It was during our coverage of the 50th anniversary of D-Day in 1994 that I was asked by Tim Russert on Meet the Press my thoughts on what we were witnessing on that occasion. As I looked over the crowd of veterans, which included cabinet officers and captains of industry, and retired school teachers and machinists, I said, "I think this is the greatest generation any society ever produced." I know it was a bold statement and a sweeping judgment, but I went on to make my case, and I believe I have the facts on my side. I see this audiobook as an American family portrait album, in which I hope especially to pay tribute to ordinary people who made extraordinary contributions to the lives we have today, and to show what fascinated me in particular about this generation, how the Depression and World War II brought out in them great personal initiative and a secure belief that by joining their efforts with the efforts of others, rich lives could be built together based on values that would endure. And this is a generation that never whined and never whimpered, no matter what was asked of them. Some of the names in this audiobook are widely known. Most, however, are more like your neighbors, the older couple who always fly the flag on the 4th of July and Veterans Day, and who spend their vacations with friends they've had for 50 years, or at a reunion of his military outfit. They seem to have everything they need, but they still count their pennies as if the bottom may fall out of the economy tomorrow. Most of all, they love each other, love life, and they love their country, and they're not ashamed to say so. I am in awe of them, these men and women who have given us the world we have today. I feel privileged to have been witness to their stories. As I came to know many of them, I became more and more moved by their everyday excellence and more convinced that this is the greatest generation in our country's history. The year of my birth, 1940, was a fulcrum of America in the 20th century, when the nation was balanced precariously between the darkness of the Great Depression on one side and the storms of war in Europe and the Pacific on the other. It was a critical time in the shaping of this nation and the world, equal to the Revolution of 1776 and the perils of the Civil War. Once again, the American people understood the magnitude of that challenge, the importance of an unparalleled national commitment, and most of all, the certainty that only one resolution was acceptable. The nation turned to its young to carry the heaviest burden, to make the fight in enemy territory, and to keep the home front secure and productive. These young men and women were eager for the assignment. They understood what was required of them, and they willingly volunteered for their duty. These Americans made up a generation birthmarked for greatness, a generation that would take its place in American history on a level with the generations that had converted the North American wilderness into the United States, and then infused the new nation with the self-determination embodied first in the Declaration of Independence, and then in the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. At the end of the 20th century, the contributions of this generation would be in bold print in any review of this turbulent and earth-altering time. It is always perilous to generalize about a whole generation, but indisputably, there are common traits that cannot be denied. It is a generation that, by and large, made no demands of homage from those who followed and prospered economically, politically, and culturally because of their sacrifices. It is a generation of towering achievement and modest demeanor, a legacy of their formative years when they were participants in and witness to sacrifices of the highest order. They know how many of the best of their generation didn't make it to their early 20s, how many brilliant scientists, teachers, spiritual and business leaders, politicians and artists were lost in the ravages of the greatest war the world has ever seen. The enduring contributions of this generation transcend gender. The world we know today was shaped not just on the front lines of combat. From the Great Depression forward, through the war and into the years of rebuilding and unparalleled progress on almost every front, women were essential to and leaders in the greatest national mobilization of resources and spirit the country had ever known. They were also distinctive in that they raised the place of their gender to heights unknown. They changed forever the perception and the reality of women in all the disciplines of American life. Millions of men and women were involved in this tumultuous journey through adversity and achievement, despair and triumph. Certainly there were those who failed to measure up. But taken as a whole, this generation did have a rendezvous with destiny that went well beyond the outsized expectations of President Roosevelt when he first issued that call to duty. The stories that follow represent the lives of some of them. Each is distinctive and yet reflective of the common experiences of that trying time and this generation of greatness. When World War II ended, more than 12 million men and women put their uniforms aside and returned to civilian life. They went back to work at their old jobs or started small businesses. They became big city cops and firemen. They finished their degrees or enrolled in college for the first time. They became school teachers, insurance salesmen, craftsmen, and local politicians. They weren't widely known outside their families or their communities. For many, the war years were enough adventure to last a lifetime. They were proud of what they had accomplished, but they rarely discussed their experiences, even with each other. They became, once again, ordinary people, the kind of men and women who always have been the foundation of the American way of life. Thomas Broderick was a 19-year-old pre-med student at Xavier College in Cincinnati in 1942, trying to decide which branch of the service fit his sense of adventure. This son of a South Chicago working-class family was bright and ambitious, so he enlisted in the Merchant Marine. "They gave us the best deal," he said. "If you didn't like it, you could quit." After 10 weeks of training, he went on a mission to North Africa on a supply ship. The pay was excellent. The food was abundant. He had a private room on the officer's deck of his ship, the John W. Brown. But the trip was long and boring. He wanted out of the Merchant Marine. He wanted to join the airborne so he could be like those cocky paratroopers he saw stationed in Algiers. "I'd never even been in a plane before," he says, "but that was the challenge I wanted." His superiors in the Merchant Marine were astonished. Here he was, ready to go back to the security of the Merchant Marine Academy for another 18 months of accelerated training, and he wanted to join one of the most dangerous outfits in the service. His commanding officer offered him a 30-day furlough to think it over. Broderick said, "No, my mind is made up." When he returned home, his parents were equally appalled. When he told his draft board what he wanted, the clerk said, "You're nuts. I'll give you another month before we draft you so you can change your mind." Broderick declined, saying he wanted in now. Tom Broderick spent 17 weeks in basic training for the infantry in Mineral Wells, Texas, before heading to Fort Benning, Georgia to become a member of the 82nd Airborne. When he finished his training, a captain offered him an instructor's job and the rank of sergeant. Again, Broderick refused the safer alternative, saying he wanted to stay with his outfit and go overseas. Broderick's units shipped out to England as replacements for the 82nd Airborne men lost in the Normandy invasion. In September, Broderick made his first jump into combat in Holland. He was in the thick of it immediately, the Battle of Arnhem. It was a joint mission of American and British paratroopers, and their objective was to take the Nijmegen Bridge to help pave the Allies' way into Germany and to discourage any German counterattack. Broderick said, "We jumped it about 500 feet because we wanted it to be a low target. It was 1:30 in the afternoon. The first German I saw, I couldn't shoot because he was riding a bicycle away from me. I couldn't shoot at him because he wasn't shooting at me." Things were different 10 minutes later. There were Germans all over the place. They outnumbered us about 40,000 to 28,000. It was combat, morning, noon, and night. On the fifth day, Broderick made a mistake that would alter his life forever. I remember being in the foxhole, and I was lining up my aim on a German. I got a little high in the foxhole, and I got shot clean through the head, through the left temple. A Catholic chaplain arrived to read the last rites, but after slipping into unconsciousness, Broderick somehow managed to stay alive until he awoke a few days later in a British hospital. He was relieved to be out of combat, but he had a problem. He couldn't see. "Why not?" he asked. His doctors told him, "When that hemorrhage clears up, you'll be all right." Broderick continued to believe them until he was sent to Dibble General Hospital in Menlo Park, California, one of the two facilities in the nation treating blind veterans. Finally, a doctor told him the truth. He would be forever blind. I was stunned. I cried, "Aren't you going to do anything?" Broderick rushed to a fellow veteran who had been hospitalized with him in England, a man recovering from shrapnel in one of his eyes. I just cried and cried, and he said to me, "We knew the whole time, Tom. We just didn't want to tell you." Broderick was angry and disoriented. When the Army made him take a rehabilitation course in Connecticut, he said, "I rebelled. I just didn't want to learn Braille. I told them I was going to work in my dad's trucking business so I could just get out of there." It didn't get much better when he returned to Chicago. He enrolled at Loyola University and the Veterans Administration hired a reader, but after only 7 weeks, Broderick dropped out and went to work for his father. His downslide continued. They didn't know what to do with me. Dad had me taking orders on the phone because I could still write, but then I heard some guys having to call back to get the orders straightened out. I thought, hell, I'm screwing up. He quit after a month. Broderick realized he'd have to learn Braille. His Veterans Administration counselor also recommended he enroll in a class in insurance sales, a fast-growing field in post-war America. He learned the insurance business by day and Braille by night. Before long, the VA found him a job with an elderly insurance broker in his neighborhood. And not too long after that, Broderick had established his own insurance business. He was no longer the young man angry at his fate. He was now prepared to accept his blindness and get on with his life. Broderick worked 6 days a week. When he wasn't taking orders by phone with his Braille machine and dictating them to his secretary later, he was making house calls at night. He quickly developed a very keen audio sense. Many customers he dealt with on the phone were astonished when they finally met him. He'd quickly call out their name when he heard their voices. Until that point, they had no idea that he was blind. Later, when he and his wife were having children, 7 in all, Broderick would tell each of them the same story as they reached the age when they could understand the real meaning of blindness. His daughter, Katie Broderick Duffy, says, "He'd tell us how he was hurt in the war, and that when he came home, he went with his mother to Lourdes, the famous shrine in France, to pray for a miracle. He said that before they put the water on his eyes, he asked the Lord a favor. 'If I can't have my eyesight back, could you find a girl for me to marry?' And that's how he met my mother." When you're little, and you hear that story, you really think it was a miracle. Broderick's wife, Eileen, is a little skeptical of the story, but Tom insists it's true, although his version is a bit breezier. "I said, 'I know we don't always get what we want, Lord, but we do get what's right for us. I'm really hoping to meet the woman for me. And if you want to throw in the eyes, too, that's okay.'" Not long after that, Tom and Eileen met on a blind date. No irony intended. Eileen was a 23-year-old nurse, and Tom was 27. She fell in love instantly. That night after the date, I went home, woke up my cousin, and said, "I've met the man I'm going to marry." She told me I'd been drinking too much, and I should go to bed. But I knew. He didn't think about his blindness. It just didn't seem to matter. He was so unique. He ran a business by himself and didn't need help from anyone, although it was a little tricky when we went out alone. I'd have to take him to the men's room and ask someone to take him in. I'd stand outside. I think being a nurse, I was a little more flexible. I understood that it was all just mechanics. My father was worried when I said I was marrying Tom. He just didn't understand how Tom could take care of me and a family. But after 3 or 4 years of marriage, they became very close. Tom's mother started him off right. When he came back from the war, she would not allow anyone to use the word blind in the home. Tom had to be treated with dignity and respect, and anything he wanted to try, he could do it. When he left his father's business to set out on his own, she was happy. Tom and Eileen had common roots as strongly faithful Roman Catholic Irish Americans. They settled into the life of the prosperous middle class on the south side of Chicago, where Tom's business continued to flourish and their family grew quickly. During one 5-year stretch, Eileen had 5 children, and then another 2 later. Eileen says he was very involved in their upbringing. There were things he could do and those he couldn't. It was kind of a trial and error. He couldn't change diapers, but he could give them a bottle. We never talked about how to make things work. It wasn't easy, but we did what we had to do. The Broderick children were part of the equation of making things work. Katie, one of his daughters, says, "The blindness was just incidental. I'd see other people who were blind and not well-adjusted and think, what's wrong with them? Later, I realized not everyone had the strength and determination of my father. When I was little, friends would say, 'Your father's not blind. He could just do so many things, it didn't seem like he was blind.'" Dan Broderick, one of Tom's sons, says his father took care of most of the household chores, including assembling an elaborate stereo system, washing and waxing the car, and changing the storm windows through a series of systems he worked out. He refused to succumb to his blindness. He even refused to let his wife Eileen get disability license plates for the family car when they became available. "What's a handicap?" he'd say. "I don't have a handicap." But then, Tom isn't much for cars. Since he can't drive himself, he likes to walk, and his family was expected to do the same. Katie remembers, "We walked everywhere. He hated getting rides. He thought it was a waste." During his introduction to the world of the blind at a rehabilitation center in Connecticut, Broderick and his friends formed an informal organization to help each other adjust to their new realities. It became the Blinded Veterans Association, and Broderick decided that he should share the lessons of his new life with other veterans who were struggling with their blindness. He began making trips to Chicago-area rehabilitation programs, counseling sightless veterans on the career possibilities in insurance, mortgage sales, and car financing, the hot financial service fields as America exploded out of the cities and into the suburbs. "I'd tell them about my own struggle, how I was young when I became blind and I knew how they felt. I brought some of them down to my office so they could see the Braille machine and what was possible. I don't feel any special bond with other blind organizations or blind people, but I wanted to help veterans. You have to do it." It was no big deal, really. Tom's son Dan remembers that during Vietnam, the nearby Veterans Administration office would send over young men who'd lost their sight in that war. "When you first saw them, you thought you were at a wake. Some of them were suicidal, with their eyes blown out. Mom would go out and get a case of beer, and they'd sit on the porch with my dad and listen to the White Sox game. Then he'd navigate them around the house to show them what we had, 5 bedrooms, a big house. By the end of the night, they'd be back on the porch, drinking beer, but laughing now." Another son, Scott. "You know how everyone says their dad is the best? Well, do you know how many people I've heard that from about my dad? Friends, neighbors, clients. Every kid thinks it, but to hear it from other people is so gratifying. He never let his disability get in the way of anything." Tom Broderick, in so many ways, embodies the best qualities of his generation. He was so eager to get involved in the war that he enlisted in 2 branches of the service. He was gravely wounded, but once he got over the initial, understandable anger, he set out to be the best husband, father, businessman, and citizen he could be, sight or no sight. It is not surprising, I suppose, that the horrors of war give birth to a new generation of Good Samaritans, young men and women who have been so intensely exposed to such inhumanity often make a silent pledge that if they ever escape this dark world of death and injuries, this universe of cruelty, they will devote their lives to good works. Sometimes the pledge is a conscious thought. Sometimes it is a subconscious reaction to their experiences. This is the story of a good Samaritan who set out in life to heal, found his greatest personal and professional test under fire, and returned home to his original calling with a renewed sense of mission. There had never been a military operation remotely approaching the scale and the complexity of D-Day. It involved 176,000 troops, more than 12,000 airplanes, and almost 10,000 ships, boats, landing crafts, frigates, sloops, and other special combat vessels, all involved in a surprise attack on the heavily fortified north coast of France to secure a beachhead in the heart of enemy-held territory so that the march to Germany and victory could begin. It was daring, risky, confusing, bloody, and ultimately glorious. It will live forever as a stroke of military genius that even though it went awry and spilled ashore in chaos, it succeeded. It was so risky that before he launched the invasion, gambling that a small break in the weather would hold, General Dwight Eisenhower personally wrote out a statement taking full responsibility for the failure if it occurred. He was grateful he never had to release it. A new generation of Americans has a greater appreciation of what was involved on D-Day as a result of Steven Spielberg's stunning film, Saving Private Ryan. For most younger Americans, D-Day had been a page or two in their history books or some anniversary ceremony on television, with a lot of white-haired men leaning into the winds coming off the English Channel as President Reagan or President Clinton praised their contributions. Saving Private Ryan, a work of fiction, was true to the sound, the fury, the death, the terrible wounds of that day. Charles O. Van Gorder was a special part of D-Day. He was a 31-year-old captain in the U.S. Army Medical Corps in June 1944, a graduate of the University of Tennessee Medical School. He'd already served in North Africa when he volunteered to be part of a two-team surgical unit that would try something new for D-Day. It would be part of the 101st Airborne Assault Force, setting up medical facilities in the middle of the fighting instead of safely behind the lines. They knew that casualties would be high and that saving lives would require immediate attention. So Captain Van Gorder and his colleagues were loaded onto gliders for the flight across the English Channel and into Normandy. These were primitive aircraft made of tubing, canvas, and plywood, with no engines, of course. They had never been used for such daring maneuvers. They were silent, giving the element of surprise, and they could land in rough terrain. Van Gorder remembers, "We landed in the field where we were supposed to, but they forgot one thing. When they put the brakes on, it made that glider like an ice sled. It went zooming across the field. We hit a tree, which ended up right between the pilot and the co-pilot. Nobody in my glider was killed, but nearly all of the other gliders had someone killed or injured." That was at 4 a.m. By 9 the same day, June 6, 1944, Van Gorder and his fellow doctors had set up an operating facility, a precursor to the MASH units, the Mobile Army Surgical Hospitals that saved so many lives and later on television gave us so much intelligent entertainment. They were located in a French chateau. They converted the milk storage room to an operating room, and by late that afternoon, the chateau grounds were covered with wounded young Americans, 300 or 400. Van Gorder and the other surgeons operated around the clock for 36 hours, always wearing their helmets because the chateau was often in the line of fire. The Army had issued the medical team several cases of Scotch whiskey, and Van Gorder later remembered, "The only thing that kept us going was sipping that Scotch. Finally, I got so tired my head fell down into an open abdomen." He was ordered to go back to his tent for some rest. En route, a soldier suggested he go to the mess area for some hot chocolate. When he turned to go back for that refreshment, a German bomb hit his tent, demolishing it. It was the first of many narrow escapes for Dr. Van, as he was called. Altogether, it was a frantic and grisly scene that even now, more than 50 years later, Dr. Van Gorder cannot remove from his memory. "I have flashbacks every day," he says. "All those boys being slaughtered, sometimes 200 boys, and only 10 surgeons. The war made me a better doctor because I had to do all kinds of surgery. There were no trauma surgery books before the war to learn from." Van Gorder's D-Day ordeal was not the end of his frontline experience. It was only the beginning. His unit stayed with the 101st over the next 6 months as it fought its way across Europe, headed for the heart of Germany. They were in the thick of the fighting during the long siege in Belgium and during the Battle of the Bulge. In December 1944, Dr. Van Gorder and his colleague and friend, Dr. John Rada, were in the middle of surgery when their makeshift operating room came under heavy fire from German forces. "I was practically lying on my stomach operating on patients," Van Gorder remembers, "because of the shooting coming right into the tent. I was the only one who spoke German, so I went to the end of the tent and waved a towel through the flap. I told the German commander we had more than 50 wounded, including German POWs. He told me to load them up. I had to leave one patient behind with his stomach open." They were taken prisoner on December 19, 1944, Dr. Van Gorder's 32nd birthday. Van Gorder had suffered shrapnel wounds in his knees while the operating tent was under fire, so his friend, Dr. Rada, supported him as they trekked through the snow under the watchful German guns. Van Gorder is convinced that without Rada's help, the Germans would have shot him as a straggler. He returned the favor when Rada became ill. Two young American doctors, who had seen more death and suffering than most graduating classes of doctors were likely to see in a lifetime, were now trying to keep each other alive. Nothing in medical school had prepared them for this primal struggle of being prisoners of war in a bleak winter landscape in the heart of enemy territory. Back home, their families had no idea of what they were going through. And it was just as well. Van Gorder, Rada, and the other prisoners were packed into boxcars, and the train moved them to the north of Germany, where they stayed on a siding for 3 days, locked inside. Half of us would stand, and half of us would sit in rotation, because it was so crowded, Van Gorder remembers. Van Gorder got out of the crowded quarters when the Germans needed a doctor to operate on a German soldier suffering from appendicitis. It was almost a fatal mission, however. American planes attacked the German train, not knowing there were Americans on board. Van Gorder ducked beneath a car to avoid the heavy fire and then told the Germans, "I'm going to let the others out." He risked his life to race into the line of fire and open the boxcar doors. The Americans poured out and immediately ran to a small hill and formed a human sign, U.S. POWs. The attacking American planes waggled their wings to indicate they understood and broke off the attack. The German army was fighting a losing battle, retreating deeper and deeper to the east, taking their prisoners with them. Van Gorder and Rada were taken first to Poland and then to the Russian border. In the confusion, they escaped and started making their way back west through Poland. Whenever they came upon a Polish hospital, they'd stop to do what they could for the patients there, as most of the Polish doctors had been conscripted by the Germans. Finally, they made their way back to the American lines in the spring of 1945. Their war was over. When I was finally discharged, I had served 5 years in the war. I was overseas for 30 months straight, Dr. Van Gorder says, without a trace of bitterness. During that time, his wife Helen, a nurse from Nova Scotia he'd met in New Jersey during his medical residency before the war, gave birth to their first son, Rod. The infant died shortly after birth, a victim of sudden infant death syndrome. Dr. Van Gorder was in North Africa at the time, a long way from his wife's side. When the war was over, Dr. Van Gorder was headed for New York in a fellowship in reconstructive surgery. No doubt it would have been a high-income, prestigious practice. Before going to New York, however, Van Gorder visited his parents who had relocated to the North Carolina mountain hamlet of Andrews. It's tucked into the Smoky Mountains in that corner where North Carolina, Tennessee, and Georgia come together. It was a logging community, the very essence of backwoods. But after the turmoil of the war, it looked like a little piece of heaven to Dr. Van Gorder. The people were plain and friendly. The village was scenic and tranquil. And there were no doctors. It was the perfect match for a young physician who had experienced enough trauma, turmoil, and uncertainty in 5 years to last a lifetime. He decided to stay in Andrews and open a practice. He called his wartime buddy and fellow surgeon John Rada and invited him to become a partner. Dr. Rada made one visit to Andrews and saw immediately what had attracted his friend. He agreed to sign on. They opened a small clinic and mini hospital above a department store. It consisted of an operating room, x-ray facilities, a blood lab, 3 examining rooms, and 21 beds. For the next 10 years, they were the only physicians in town. They really didn't intend to stay forever, but they quickly came to love their practices, their patients, and their adopted home. Dr. Van Gorder's son, Chuck, remembers his dad being very busy, and some evenings so exhausted he'd fall asleep at the dinner table. When the clinic closed at 5:30 in the evening, Chuck recalls, my mother, who was the nurse, took the names of all the people who were too sick to come to town. We'd all get in the station wagon with our parents, and they'd make their nightly rounds of house calls. They did this every night. I don't think my dad ever left town the same time as Dr. Rada. Andrews had a tough element, and someone was always getting hurt in a fight or getting shot. Even so, some of the people in town didn't trust Dad and Dr. Rada because they were so young, and folks around here were used to older doctors. So Dad and Dr. Rada brought in an older doctor from a nearby town to just be in the operating room when they did surgery. In return, they'd operate on that doctor's patients without charging him. Chuck Van Gorder remains in awe of his father and what he meant to his neighbors. Even after he retired, he remembers, people kept asking for him. A friend of mine was working for the power company when he blew his hands off in an accident. He was delirious. He kept screaming, I want Dr. Van. Dr. Van will make this all right. The Van Gorders kept their faith in their God, in each other, and in the belief that life is about helping others. They pass that along to their 2 daughters and surviving son. That's another legacy of the World War II generation. The strong commitment to family values and community. They were mature beyond their years in their 20s, and when they married and began families, it was not a matter of thinking, well, let's see how this works out. They applied the same values to their professional lives. They never stopped thinking about how they could improve the health care for their community. While they were building their practice, Van Gorder and Rada realized Andrews deserved more than their modest clinic and small hospital, so they set out to build a real hospital. Dr. Van Gorder became a regular visitor to the state capitol in Raleigh, lobbying the governor to apply for federal Hill-Burton funds to build a hospital in Andrews. He succeeded. When the hospital was completed in 1956, it was a community triumph. Local residents working in the mills contributed through a payroll deduction program, sometimes as little as a nickel a week, or through bank contribution programs. Now, the hospital has 60 beds and a full range of medical services from x-rays to surgery. It is being expanded to accommodate 16 more doctors in a community that had none when the war ended. Van Gorder's friend and partner, Dr. Rada, died 6 years ago, and Van Gorder has been struggling with his own health problems. He suffered a small stroke in 1997. But he's still cheerful and grateful for a full life. The thing I am most proud of is that hospital, he says. If I had my life to do it all over again, I'd go the same way. Go somewhere small where people have a need, contribute something to people who need it, help people. Captain Charles Van Gorder, in a makeshift operating facility in a French chateau courtyard, on that blustery June day in Normandy, drenched in blood and working frantically to save the lives of wounded young American soldiers, the sounds of war all around him didn't have time to think about his future. but it was an experience that in so many ways shaped his values and his philosophy about his medical training. Generations of North Carolina logging families who later came to his door, seeking either his healing powers for broken bones, measles, and mumps, or his tender touch for delivering babies and for easing the way through terminal illnesses, were the beneficiaries of all that Dr. Van Gorder learned in June 1944 about the deepest meaning of a medical education, about taking care of people. Women had so many roles in World War II, from serving on the front lines as nurses to taking the place of men on the assembly lines. They were also the wives and sweethearts of the fighting men, and in that role, they were the moral support back home, and the reason many men said they were so determined to stay alive. Jeanette Gagne Norton of suburban Minneapolis was just 17 when she met Camille Gagne, a native of Quebec, as the war was getting underway. They had a 6-month courtship and decided to marry in June 1942 because Camille knew his draft number was coming up. Jeanette became pregnant shortly after they were wed, and he left for basic training that autumn. Following basic, Camille volunteered for the 82nd Airborne, which meant additional training at Fort Benning, Georgia. He had hoped to get a furlough after airborne training, but the Army wanted his unit to ship out immediately. He called Jeanette with the bad news shortly after she'd gotten home from the hospital with their newborn son. Jeanette says, "Tears welled up in my eyes. I said, 'I guess you won't be able to see our boy.' And he says, 'Well, I wish I could hear him cry.' I had a little gold necklace on, and just then the baby caught his finger in it and really started to cry. So I was glad Camille could leave knowing at least he'd heard his son cry." Camille had one other request of Jeanette. He said, "Whatever you do, don't name him Camille." Jeanette promised she wouldn't. In Canada, that name Camille wasn't unusual for a boy, but in the States it was. Jeanette decided to call their boy Robert, Bob. Jeanette had to grow up fast, married, a mother, and her husband off to war. All of that happened before she was 20. When they placed that baby in my arms, I changed from being a kind of giddy, goofy teenager to being a real, responsible person. Seems like I matured overnight. Her husband was going through his own maturation process. His outfit went from Fort Benning to North Africa for additional training, and then into battle in Sicily and Salerno. Camille was injured, although not seriously, when a landing went bad on one of his jumps, so he was sent to England for recuperation and kept there to train for the D-Day invasion in the spring of 1944. He wrote when he could, and Jeanette remembers the letters sometimes arriving 5 or 6 at a time. She shared them with the women at Honeywell in Minneapolis, where she had gone to work, assembling automatic pilot instrumentation for warplanes. Her mother moved in to care for the baby when Jeanette got the job at Honeywell. "When I'd go to work, I'd say, 'I got a letter from my husband today,' and I'd share that. They'd say, 'Yeah, I got one too,' and they'd share it. It was real close." Jeanette's mother, however, was having a hard time keeping up with the newborn back at home. So after about 9 months, they switched roles, and Jeanette stayed home with the baby while her mother worked. Still, she was an energetic young woman, and spending all of her time with a toddler was not easy. So she wrote Camille, asking his permission to attend the weekend dances at nearby Fort Snelling. As she recalls now, he wrote back to say, "Okay, but just don't get too interested in someone." Jeanette and 2 or 3 friends would ride out to the Fort Snelling Armory in streetcars and dance the night away. "I would dance with just about every branch of the armed forces, I guess," she recalls. Of course, some of the questions were, "I guess you must get pretty lonesome." But I just said, "I'm married, and I have a baby, and I just enjoy being here dancing." It was fun, but it was hard because some of them were out of small towns for the first time and missing their families. So I felt like I was helping the war effort. Jeanette says Camille didn't have anything to worry about. "I didn't want to do anything to upset my marriage, and being where he was at the time, it wouldn't have been right. I was so glad to have our son because every time I looked at him, it would be like part of my husband was there, especially when I'd hold him and hug him. Camille stayed in the thick of battle. He survived his D-Day experience, one of the lucky members of the 82nd Airborne to land near his objective, the village of San Maraglise, and not get killed or wounded. When his unit returned to England following the Normandy invasion, Camille wrote to Jeanette saying, "I'm going again. After Normandy, I have one more battle, then I'll be headed home." The objective was Nijmegen, on the border between Germany and Holland, a critical crossing of the Rhine River. The operation, under the direction of Britain's Field Marshal Montgomery, was codenamed Market Garden. In another unit of the 82nd Airborne, Thomas Broderick, the former merchant marine, was sent into battle at Arnhem. Camille jumped into battle September 19, 1944, and he was immediately in a ferocious fight for control of a bridge at Nijmegen. His outfit was greatly outnumbered, fighting against the well-fortified German forces, part of Hitler's desperate attempt to counter the losses that began with the D-Day invasion. Back home, young Bob was just 17 months old. Jeanette was home with him when there was a knock at the door. It was a Western Union man. Jeanette remembers every detail to this day. He says, "Are you Mrs. Gagne? I have this telegram for you. Are you going to be okay?" I said, "Oh, sure, I'm okay." When I opened it, I thought it would say your husband was wounded. But when it said, "We regret to inform you your husband was killed in action," oh boy, I picked up our little boy and started crying real loud. The bridge at Nijmegen was captured by the Allied forces against great odds. The preeminent British military historian of World War II, John Keegan, called it a brilliant success. Camille Gagne was an important part of that success. Operating from a bombed-out building on the western bank of the Rhine and armed only with light weapons, bazookas, and grenades, his squad kept the Germans from counterattacking across the bridge. Before reinforcements could arrive, however, the Germans rolled up one of their deadly 88mm guns and opened fire on Gagne's position. He was killed instantly. He was awarded the Silver Medal posthumously. It was presented to Jeanette in ceremonies at Fort Snelling. It was, she says, a very sad, sad day. The Minneapolis Star and Tribune took a photograph of Jeanette with 2-year-old Bob wearing the Silver Star won by his father, who had never seen him. It was the end of one life for this young woman, and the beginning of another. My mother was working, Jeanette remembers, and I'd watch Bob play on the floor, and I wonder, what was going to happen to us? Would I ever marry again? I wondered if I'd find a man who would be good to my boy. I used to sit and wonder a lot about what would happen to me. Her future was uncertain, but she was grateful for one thing. Young Bob resembled his father so much she knew Camille would live on through him. When she did meet another man and fall in love a second time, they agreed he would not adopt Bob, so the Gagne family name could be continued. Her second husband, William Norton, was the only real father Bob had ever known, and he met the test of loving him as his own son. In fact, Jeanette says Norton considered it an honor to raise the son of a World War II hero, and there was never any resentment when Camille's name came up. When Bob was a teenager, he announced to his mother that one day he'd go visit his father's grave in Holland. Jeanette didn't think much about the promise since she was busy with her new life. She had 3 daughters with William Norton, and they led a happy existence in a Minneapolis suburb. When Norton died of a heart attack in 1993, after 45 years of marriage, Jeanette was, as she says now, alone with her thoughts, and they took her back to World War II and Camille. By now, Bob, an engineer with a major Twin Cities radio station, was also determined to fulfill his teenage pledge to visit his father's final resting place. His mother and stepfather had always kept his father in his life, reminding him of Camille's birthday, discussing his heroism when news of World War II would come along. Bob decided it was time to somehow try to connect to the father he had never known. When he arrived at the American cemetery in the Netherlands, he was not prepared for the full impact on his emotions. As he says of his father, here was a young guy who basically had his whole life in front of him. He had a young wife in the States and a son he had never seen. He was in a strange country, but he continued to fight with valor for his country. Tears came. Yeah, I did feel a kinship with him. People would have a hard time understanding. But I feel closer to him than I would have otherwise. Bob brought back a videotape of his father's headstone, the cemetery, and the chapel to share with his mother and his three stepsisters. It was an intensely emotional experience for all of them. The younger people felt an association with the values of their parents' time and generation that might have eluded them. Jeanette was reminded of her first love, the father of her first child, a man she knew for less than a year before he went off to war, the soldier husband.